This morning, we welcome UUFM member Shelley McCormick as our speaker. She and her husband John moved to Middle Tennessee from San Francisco Bay Area 10 years ago. Shelley is a senior software quality analyst at Tractor Supply Company and a diehard bookworm. Shelley enjoys many genres, but post-apocalyptic and dystopian novels have a special place in her library. Shelley's topic is the history of the end of the world. Let's welcome Shelley.
Good morning. So, off book here. If you're a new member, and what I have to say, or a new visitor, and what I have to say makes you go, really? What? Come back next week, there'll be somebody else. One of the things I love about Unitarian Universalism, and especially about this fellowship, is being part of a community of very interesting and well-informed and group of critical thinkers, but I did underestimate how intimidated that would make me feel right about now. So let me start with a few disclaimers. I am not an expert on the Bible. I'm not an expert on the Book of Revelations. I know a little bit about the Cold War, but not much more than the average baby boomer. I don't know if, when, or how this planet will reach its literal end, and I don't know if any humans will be around to see it. But as Kitty mentioned, I'm an avid bookworm. I read a lot of dystopian and post-apocalyptic literature, and some of my favorite movies involve the end of the world as we know it. I'm fascinated by what people think about the end. And I'm going to have to give myself a time check here, sorry. My favorite Twilight Zone episode, I'm sure many of you have seen it, Time Enough to Last. Harold Bemis, it's the story of a man, as Rod Serling says, who seeks salvation in the rubble of a ruined world. A bookish little man whose passion is the printed page, but who is conspired against by a bank president and a wife and a world full of tongue cluckers and the unrelenting hands of a clock. I was pretty young when I saw it for the first time, but I got it. Now that I need glasses to read, I keep a spare in my nightstand, another in my car, in my laptop bag. I have another, you know, my old prescription. Every year I get a new one, I keep the old one. Few others tucked away around the house, a couple pairs in my emergency preparedness bag. That episode spoke to me. So first let's talk just for a second about the difference between dystopian and post-apocalyptic literature. I don't know how many of you tend to gravitate towards those types of imaginations. I found a really good explanation on Goodreads. David Nix is an author who posted in his blog there. A dystopia is a society where societal perfection or societal transcendence is obtained at the expense of something else. That something else could be devalued class of people, the loss of fundamental freedom, or the surrender of some aspect of human nature. Literary dystopias often arise through a slow process of societal change, or more abruptly, as the result of some cataclysm. In either case, the dystopia represents society in a stable state, albeit a state most of us find appalling in some manner. Post-apocalyptic literature, on the other hand, focuses on the instability during and or following a cataclysmic event that shatters society in both form and headcount. During the story, whatever society exists is typically small, isolated, and highly threatened. Often, there's little hope or no hope for any meaningful future. Although it's true that post-apocalyptic events can lead to the formation of dystopian societies, it is the immediately endangered nature of the society that interests me as a reader. I grew up in a small town in California named Livermore. Some of you may have heard of it. Those of you who were aware of Cold War happenings in the 60s and 70s. I went to school about a mile from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which was then known as the Livermore Radiation Laboratory, or the Rad Lab, as we called it affectionately. where thermonuclear weapons and defense systems were designed. We had duck and cover drills. Anybody else have duck and cover drills? Because you know that by closing the curtains and getting under your desk, that was going to save you. There was a fallout shelter under the post office. I believe it's still there. Air raid sirens we heard once a week. My junior high school teacher once told us, just chatting before class, that when the Russians attacked, the Rad Lab would be their first target. But it was okay, because I already knew that. And I'm sure that some of you here had the same knowledge about your hometowns during those times, that whether you lived in New York or near Chicago or Los Angeles, that your town would be on the list. I think that's probably a lot of what contributed to nuclear war and its aftermath being such a popular theme in literature and movies during the last half of the 20th century, a lot like zombies are today. But a zombie apocalypse and nuclear winter aren't our only options. If you were to Google, as I did, most likely ways the world will end, you'll get lists upon lists, the 5 top ways, the 10 top ways, the 7, 9, the 12, the 20, the 30 most likely ways that the world, the earth, all living things, maybe just all of humanity, or maybe just civilization as we know it, might end. Things like asteroid impacts, alien invasions, super volcanoes, Verneshot. Has anyone ever heard of Verneshot? Verneshot, named for Jules Verne. It's like a volcano, except instead of like lava flowing and ash spewing, you've got gigantic rocks shot into space that fall back down. Cool, yeah, right. I never heard of that before, and that's just one more thing to add to my list of things to lie awake thinking about at night. We have Gulf Stream shutdown, overpopulation, bioweapons, electromagnetic pulses. One of my favorite post-apocalyptic novels has that as the event. Gamma ray bursts, solar flares, a pandemic, climate change, a very real threat. Ecosystem collapse, biotech disaster, particle accelerator mishap, et cetera, et cetera. And a side note, I did not see Wrath of God on any of those lists as I was looking through them. So, this end of the world stuff, it's nothing new. As soon as the words "in the beginning" were first spoken, that presupposes that there is an end. I read a very interesting book a number of years ago called A History of the End of the World. That's where my title for this topic came from, by Yuri Rubinsky and Ian Wiseman. And they give in the table of contents the actual history of the end of the world. From 4032 BC to the 80s AD, the world's major religions and great mythic sources illuminate for us our place as mortals on a mortal earth. The Old Testament prophets turn the Garden of Eden into a paradise that will accompany the end of the world. All we need is someone to lead us there. 30 AD to 1000 AD, Christ is born and talks mostly about the kingdom of heaven. Visionaries, theologians, and oracles reshape his view of the end, bringing it down to earth and expecting it to arrive later this afternoon. 1000 AD to 1492. By the year 1000, everyone's in on the fun. Messiahs appear frequently and always gather followers. Humanity, particularly the radical and the poor, realizes that radical action can move the end closer. Actions such as fighting the Crusades or discovering America. 1492 to the 1890s, the Americas get to live through the first of the man-induced ends. Europeans discover themselves to be as deadly as the plague, as efficient as the flood. The native tribes and nations discover what the Europeans already knew. All they can hope for in times of distress is the possibility of paradise. They figure God won't let white people in. 1760s to present, and at that time, the present was 1982 when this book was written. Meanwhile, back in the old world, the popularity of visionaries and doomsayers, quacks, cults, and serious religions never wanes. Soon there in the Americas, too, as major changes shake up the world's belief, the end remains constant and pure, but diversifies. Paradise becomes even more alluring. And here in America, 1760s to present, The Industrial Revolution directs our imagination to the ends of the world brought about by technology. Science picks up where industry left off, inventing for the first time the end that might really be final. Science fiction is born and reminds us, on the one hand, that we can precipitate our own end, and at the same time, that forces loose in the universe are of such a scale that we may never know what hit us. So why are we so, why am I so, I won't speak for everybody here, fascinated with all these theories and concepts and possibilities for the end of the world? Tom Zollner wrote Uranium War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. He asked, is there a corner of the mind that is biologically predisposed to believe in an imminent end to the earth? The staggering number of religions and philosophies that forecast a burning before a final age of light makes it a question worth examining. Historian Eugene Weber wrote, I think it was around the 80s, we yearn for some explosive, extraordinary escape from the inescapable, and none forthcoming, we put our faith in an apocalyptic rupture whereby the inevitable is solved by the unbelievable. Grasshoppers, plagues, composite monsters, angels, blood in industrial quantities, and, in the end, salvation from sin and evil meaning anxiety, travail, and pain. By defining human suffering in cosmic terms as part of a cosmic order that contains an issue, catastrophe is dignified, endowed with meaning, and hence made bearable. Weber was an agnostic, and he also spoke in 1989 of people lonely in a godless world, saying, the world has always been disgracefully managed, but now you no longer know to whom to complain. So the book of Revelations, apocalypse actually is the Greek word for revelation, not for disaster. But it's really come to mean that because that book of Revelation has had such a profound effect on Western civilization and on the world. It's inspired countless books, movies, art, music, and fears. Anything you see about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the mark of the beast, the second coming of Christ, the seven seals, the starry crown, that all came from there. I read in Wired magazine that if John of Patmos, who was the guy who, on whatever he was on, actually wrote the book of Revelations, if he ever hooked up with a good intellectual property attorney, he could unleash a cataclysmic lawsuit like nothing the world has ever seen before. And Thomas Paine, in The Age of Reason, commented that the most detestable wickedness, the most horrid cruelties, and the greatest miseries that have afflicted the human race have had their origin in this thing called revelation. So there are some different viewpoints out there on why people keep flocking to go see those movies and go read those books. You might say that our reality may not be bad, but you know it could be worse. At least it's not that bad. We might say that it's driven by fear and the popularity of different scenarios for the end tend to be driven by our very real fears of what's going on in the world right now in politics and science. I heard an interview on NPR a couple of months ago. Emily St. John Mandel, who wrote Station 11, said that it's a combination of pessimism and narcissism. Humans want to believe that we're on the climax of things. Todd Mitchell said post-apocalyptic books offer us an escape from denial. Right now we know on some deeply unconscious or maybe even conscious level that we're screwing things up. We know that all our pollution and overconsumption is driving the planet to ruin. We might not accept the science of climate change. I do. But we can't ignore the droughts, floods, superstorms, forest fires, heat waves, and other signs of a world spinning out of balance. Nor can we ignore the many signs of social inequality leading to civil unrest. But here's the tricky thing. On the surface, things look pretty good right now. But deep down, we know there are problems. And we either deny that things are good, or we deny that there are underlying problems, or we deny everything and go see a movie. From Margaret Perrottet, perhaps much of the interest in the post-apocalyptic theme is the fantasy of getting thrown into a time, and I think this speaks to a lot of people who go see those kinds of movies and those books. It kind of speaks to me a little bit. It's the fantasy of getting thrown into a time where, although more precarious, is much less complex. So many people in the world are disgusted, angry, and just plain overwhelmed with the way the world is today. We long to have a society where things are far less complicated. After all, in the post-apocalyptic world, there's no boss, no government, no mortgage, car, or credit card payments. We long to have a government that's free from corruption. We're disgusted with the problems that we see in society and want to rebuild it. It's not that we really want something horrible to happen, but the post-apocalyptic world offers us a fantasy which, if we were to survive, it's kind of a big if, actually, with some of these, if we were to survive, there is a chance for renewal and a fresh start on both an individual and a societal level. Going back to Rubinsky and Wiseman in their History of the End of the World, they wrote that visions and warning of the end are, without exception, reaction to an existing or threatening social, moral, political, or physical condition. This is the paradox of the end. It keeps people's minds off subjects of the infinite. It replaces spiritual vastnesses with petty concerns about signs, omens, warnings, admonitions, strategies, campaigns, small steps. So, as evidenced by the fact that we're all here today, most visions of the end have not come true, at least not on a global scale. The world did not, in fact, end on my 35th birthday. That was predicted back in the 17th century by the Bishop of Ireland based on his calculations of the date of creation plus 6,000 years happened to fall on a propitious day for me. Did not end on December 21st, 2012. The next day, Grumpy Cat declared that as the worst apocalypse ever. did not end any of the times that Harold Camping thought it would and proclaimed it would to his followers. So far, we're still all here. But we've known from the very first thoughts of the beginning of the end that the end is inevitable. It will come eventually, whether it comes in about 15 years on the 2000th anniversary of the crucifixion. I'm thinking probably not. Whether it ends in 2060, as Sir Isaac Newton, suggested based on his study of the Bible. Whether it comes in 5 billion years when the Earth falls into the sun, or whether it comes in 20 billion years when the universe rips apart. For some, it's already come in the form of hurricanes, wildfires, from war, from epidemics. For others, it's come from a visit to the doctor, or a phone call in the middle of the night. No matter what happens, in 100 years, we'll all be dead. The question is, are you ready? Is it enough for you to have an emergency kit with some expired Excedrin and some old Band-Aids hidden away in the back of the closet? Do you have an emergency kit that'll let you survive for a few days or a week without electricity or running water? I do highly recommend that. Growing up in San Francisco, that was one of the things. 3 days. You have to be prepared for 3 days in case of earthquake. And that came in handy when there was earthquakes. So wherever you are, whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever your belief system is, that's a good idea. Is it practical to devote all of your resources and all of your energies to stockpiling food and weapons and building bunkers where you or your family can survive for years? I'm thinking that if I did that the end of days would probably come while I was on vacation in Disneyland, 3,000 miles away from all my shelves of canned goods and ammunition. So I wonder, yes, if the doomsday preppers if they are engaged in a modern day version of duck and cover. The reality is that the world comes to an end every day for over 150,000 people, for their families, friends, for those who loved them and depended on them. It's the end of life as they knew it. Every day, thousands of people enter their own personal post-apocalyptic or dystopian worlds, brought about by events unnoticed by the rest of us. Are you prepared for that? Can you weather the loss of a job? Do you have a will? If you have minor children, have you made known your choice for who would care for them if you were gone? As a parent, I can tell you, that was more terrifying to me than any asteroid or any epidemic could have ever been. So, in short, make your preparations for the things you can prepare for. Then set aside the worry. Put it in the closet with your bug-out bag. Pull it out once a year to make sure nothing's expired. Keep working for a better world. Don't forget about what we can do to make it better. But work with resolve and hope rather than out of fear. And at the end of the day, think of the words of the poet Kalidasa. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence. The bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of achievement are but experiences of time. For yesterday is but a dream. Tomorrow is only a vision. And today, well lived, makes yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Such is the salutation to the ever new dawn. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this day.